This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about David Gilbert's new book, Love and Struggle.
This extraordinary book by a man who is currently serving a 75-year-to-life sentence teaches us all lessons of the past and lessons that will help with the future.
In a disturbing revelation, we'll hear how the U.S. government actually used Guatemalans as test subjects.
Most of us have heard of Tuskegee and the experimenting on African Americans with syphilis. Here's one you probably don't know. It was done by some of the same people in Guatemala.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Heidi, you've been giving us periodic updates on Mamiya. He got off death row. He got out of solitary. I know you visit him, and I know you have another update on Mamiya.
We have a brief update, Michael. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court on March 26 rejected Mumia's appeal of his capital murder conviction. They issued a one-page order agreeing with a lower court decision denying, without a hearing, Mumia's claim that a 2009 report that came out by the National Academy of Science and that exposed serious flaws in forensic evidence routinely introduced in criminal trials demonstrated that the forensic evidence the Philadelphia County DA's office relied on in its 1982 prosecution of Mumia was unreliable. Because the forensic evidence that was presented at his trial was untrustworthy, and because reliable and potentially exculpatory forensic evidence was never secured or presented by the state, accuracy of the jury's first-degree murder conviction was seriously undermined. So basically, that's the argument that his lawyers put forth.
You used the term forensic evidence. Do you know what evidence are we talking about that his lawyers claimed was botched by the DA?
They did not do a proper forensic study. They didn't test, for example, Mumia's hands for gunshot residue. There were inconsistencies, I think, in the ballistics report. But what had happened was in 2009, this National Academy of Science came out with a report saying that forensic evidence used in criminal trials is often hugely flawed, and certainly in Mumia's case, they really didn't do a proper forensic examination.
So the court turns down the appeal with a one-pager. This is already, in many different phases of the case.
Right.
But there's really not much you can do after that. I mean, you can go to the Supreme Court.
The only thing you could do is go to the Supreme Court. They're not going to hear it.
Right.
Although this decision does conclude Mumia's pending appeals, and again, this was in the Philadelphia Supreme Court, the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund and his other attorney, Professor Judy Ritter, are actively researching and investigating all options for future legal challenges in his case.
But of course, he is still off death row and will be forever.
Yes.
He can never be put back onto the death penalty. But this is now on the underlying conviction for the murder, and so that is still going to be appealed again and again, I'm sure.
The only option, really, aside from an executive pardon by the governor, is under the AEDPA, the 1996 anti-effective death penalty and terrorism law that Clinton passed. The only basis for getting Mumia a new trial would be if newly discovered evidence that could not have been discovered at the earlier phase comes forward. And so investigations continue, and the hope is that something will arise.
Heidi, is there a website for keeping up on Mumia's case?
The Free Mumia website is a comprehensive source of information on his case. Michaels, we had another bad Supreme Court decision last week. This one involves holding that local police can strip search anyone arrested for minor offenses if they're to be held in the jail's general population.
We're talking 14 million arrests a year. They can now strip somebody naked for making an illegal left turn or for sitting in at a demonstration.
Our concern, and I think the numbers of individuals that this impacts are largely African Americans.
Well, I can be, obviously, because like driving while black. So someone's picked up because they're black, whether it's on the New Jersey Turnpike or anywhere else. like the guy, the plaintiff in this case, they get taken to prison and they get strip searched. So it's going to affect, it already has, African-Americans, Latinos, and other minorities much more than it's going to affect the white population.
And the irony here is that the week before, they heard arguments against Obamacare, and the conservative justices on the Supreme Court were worried about the power of the state. Can you force somebody to buy broccoli? How can you force somebody to buy insurance? It looks like they want to strike down the Obamacare rule, but on this one, they uphold the power of the state to strip search a potentially 14 million people because of arrests for minor crimes. What does it show me? It shows me that the Supreme Court is an utterly political body.
Well, now the court's conservative majority argued that the strip searches were necessary to protect anyone arrested from other so-called dangerous people and also to protect law enforcement officials and to keep order in jails, something they say quite frequently. But we know that this is going to be used, as many law enforcement tactics are, as a bullying and intimidation factor. And I would also imagine that in addition to the hundreds of thousands of people of color who are subjected to this, people with political views challenging government policies now, if you're arrested, for example, at an Occupy event, could be subject to strip searches. Just the way we reported recently in New York, they're subject now to iris scans. Although it's not mandatory, many judges are erroneously saying it's mandatory. Which and if they don't submit, they're kept longer. And I imagine with a strip search, I guess you can't really refuse.
You can't refuse. And so it is going to subject a lot of, obviously, as we said, African-Americans and others to strip search, but also it can be punitively used as a threat against activists as well. A couple of interesting things about the case. One is that it has to do with you're arrested for something minor, they're taken, you're booked, and then you're put into general population. And what their argument or the government's argument is, well, we're putting them in general population. What if the person has a weapon on them? And you see some, quote, logic to that. On the other hand, there are many states and the federal government itself that doesn't actually, 10 states, that don't actually strip search people in this situation. You need, maybe not the equivalent of probable cause, but you need reasonable suspicion that the person who's being brought in might have a weapon of some sort secreted on them in some place that you need to strip search them. So there's actually a standard, so it wasn't necessary for the Supreme Court to go in this direction. The second thing I think that's really important to understand when we talk about the Supreme Court and the Gang of Four, which are the really right-wing guys, and Kennedy gets thrown in there in the middle, going sometimes to the less dark side, but mostly with the bad guys, is that Obama administration actually supported the 5-4 decision of the Supreme Court. They actually asked the court, or at least made a statement, I think they actually asked the court, to say we want a uniform rule upheld and it should include the right to strip search whoever gets picked up. So there you go. You think that, yeah, Obama's going to make better justices, and he did this time. Of course, we have Sotomayor and Kagan are certainly better than Alito and Roberts. But here you have the Obama administration siding with the strip searchers. So that tells you a lot about Obama. The other thing I think you have to understand when we talk about, oh, we have to vote for Obama because the Supreme Court will be better, at least if you look at those two, is certainly a possibility. But you have to also understand that Alito and Roberts were both put in, as I recall, when the Democrats could have stopped both
right.
nominations.
Right.
The Democrats had a filibuster-proof ability to stop both those nominations, and they didn't. So when you blame the Supreme Court, you have to also blame Obama, and you have to blame the Democrats for not, when they knew better, stopping Roberts and Alito from getting on the court. Let me tell you, the Republicans would have never allowed very progressive people to get on the court.
All I can say is drive more carefully because a traffic infraction could land you with a strip search.
Michael, we've been following what's been happening with Gaza ever since the Israelis bombed it and killed over 1,000 people and several hundred children. The case should have gone to the International Criminal Court. Give us an update on that.
Well, we all, as you know, we've been following what happened in 2009 in Gaza and the number of Palestinians killed. And the Palestinians made a complaint to the International Criminal Court at The Hague saying they should begin an investigation of the Israeli bombing and killings in Gaza. Now, the International Criminal Court, which, of course, goes after African dictators all the time, has limited jurisdiction. It has jurisdiction over states that have consented to its jurisdiction. So the United States hasn't consented. That's why it doesn't get the United States. Or it can go after people who commit crimes on states that have consented. So if you commit a crime in Canada, let's say, can go to the International Criminal Court because they've consented. Or the UN can refer people to the International Criminal Court. Let's look at what happened here. The UN didn't refer the Israel attack on Gaza or anything to do with that to the International Criminal Court. Israel did not sign the treaty for the International Criminal Court. On the other hand, Gaza and Palestine basically said, we acknowledge jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court, Gaza and the West Bank. And so then the question before the International Criminal Court becomes, can we consider this complaint by the Palestinians against Israel? And the question they had to deal with was, is Palestine a state? If Palestine is not a state, then it's, I guess, arguable, more than arguable, that the ICC doesn't have jurisdiction over the crimes committed in Gaza. So it's been 3 years now. The prosecutor opened a preliminary investigation to make the determination of whether Gaza is a state. So the decision the prosecutor made was whether Palestine is a state, and therefore he could investigate crimes committed in Gaza by Israel or crimes committed in the West Bank by Israel. He did a three-year investigation, and despite the fact that 130 states have recognized Palestine as a state, and UNESCO apparently has now as well, the prosecutor determined that Palestine is not a state, and therefore the International Criminal Court has no jurisdiction over crimes committed or alleged crimes committed by Israel in Gaza or in the West Bank. Now, what's remarkable, that a number of organizations actually objected to the International Criminal Court's ruling, among them particularly Amnesty International and I think Human Rights Watch as well. And what they said is, who is the prosecutor to make this decision? This is not a decision that's up to the prosecutor about whether Palestine is a state. A judicial decision that should have been made by the judges at the International Criminal Court and not by the prosecutors. And so that these groups, particularly Amnesty, is labeling it as an utterly political, politicized decision by the prosecutor at the International Criminal Court. So it's a very, very bad decision. It essentially leaves Israel immune for the crimes it committed in Gaza because it can't go to the International Criminal Court on its own. Palestine can't. The UN is not referring it to the International Criminal Court, and therefore there is no justice, really, for what happened in Gaza in the war that took place in 2009.
Written by David Gilbert from his New York prison cell, Love and Struggle, My Life in SDS, The Weather Underground and Beyond, is just out. From the early anti-Vietnam War protests to the founding of SDS at Columbia, the Columbia strike, through the tragedy of the townhouse, Gilbert was on the scene as an organizer, theatrician, and above all an activist. He was among the first militants who went underground to build the clandestine resistance to war and racism known as Weathermen. And he was among the last to emerge in captivity after the disaster of the 1981 Brinks robbery, an attempted expropriation that resulted in four deaths and long-term prison sentences. Gilbert has been serving hard time in New York prisons for the last three decades. And in his new book, readers learn of his personal history and continued political relevance. As Mumia Abu-Jamal said of the book, Gilbert adds heart and bone to the stuff of history. We're joined by two guests, Naomi Jaffe, who was an SDS with Gilbert, and Dan Berger, a younger friend of Gilbert's, to talk about Love and Struggle. We go now to Dan Berger first. Dan, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be here.
Dan, I know you from a previous work of your own, Outlaws in America, The Weather Underground, and The Politics of Solidarity. You've been instrumental because of your friendship with David Gilbert, helping David write Love and Struggle, My Life in SDS, The Weather Underground and Beyond. David, as our listeners may know, is serving a sentence of 75 years to life. He's in prison in Auburn, New York, for a botched Brinks bank robbery 30-some years ago. He wrote this book from his prison cell, and I wanted to ask you, Dan, how did you get to know David?
You know, David's been in prison my whole life. He was arrested, you know, a month before I was born, in October of 1981. I got to know him, you know, I didn't know anything about him sort of growing up, but when I became an activist as a teenager, I was looking for mentors, for people who had a sense of what worked and didn't work politically, and how to think strategically, and heard about the 60s as this era of protest and struggle, but couldn't really see it reflected in any of the adults I knew or in my kind of day-to-day life in the suburb. So ultimately, I came across a group supporting political prisoners, and I started writing several of them, and David was one of them, the person who with whom I developed the closest relationship that started with letters, and he just was so patient and gracious in answering all of my many questions, just really helping me, think about race and empire and sort of my own role in the world. And that ultimately kind of blossomed into, a sort of lifelong friendship. He was at the center of my book on the Weather Underground. And now with Love and Struggle, I got to repay the favor a little bit.
Well, I understand that the genesis of the book was David's responding to a request from his son, Chase Aboudin, who said, "Dad, why don't you write a book about your own personal experiences?" Because he had previously written a book, really a book of polemics, called No Surrender. Chase asked his father, David Gilbert, if he could write a book about his personal experiences, and now we're actually able to hold that book, Love and Struggle, in our hands. What were the lessons that you drew as a young person from the book?
Now that I'm over 30, I stop identifying as a young person so much.
I wish I was 30.
I take that lesson from the 60s. One of the things that has been so wonderful about David is his ability to stay grounded and empathic despite over 30 years in prison. And I think he's done a really phenomenal job in Love and Struggle of walking us through the thought process, how he made these decisions that led him from being a kind of naive, suburbanite growing up in Brookline, Massachusetts, to becoming a slightly less naive liberal, to becoming, an activist at Columbia working on civil rights and some of the earliest anti-war efforts, to becoming a radical and then to becoming a revolutionary. And I think the intentionality with which he goes through his decision-making process and shows us how someone can live, in the belly of the beast, so to speak, and make decisions about living life in solidarity with the rest of the world, I think is the greatest gift of the book.
Dan, I think that one of the reasons this prison industrial complex and our mass over-incarceration problem in the United States has grown so large is because of the dehumanizing of the individuals behind bars. Once a face and a family and a narrative is attached to any one individual, it becomes harder to depersonalize that. Have you and David discussed that?
You're certainly right. That's one of the greatest things we can do to undermine the power of mass incarceration is to humanize all of the millions of people that are wrapped up in it, in that system. Certainly we've discussed that a lot in a variety of ways, and David himself has done a wonderful job, less in his own case, but then in humanizing figures like Mumia Abu-Jamal and in all of the efforts he's done, that David has done to support other political prisoners, especially from the Black Liberation Movement. I think in his own case, David was reluctant to write about prison conditions, and Love and Struggle is not at all a prison memoir. I think it's quite rare, in fact, to have a book written by a prisoner that's not about prison conditions. The humanizing effect that comes from the book is not about him describing, all of the harassment and abuse that he's suffered inside, but is, in fact, seeing him as a full person. Right? This whole memoir about his decades as an activist prior to his incarceration.
We're speaking with Dan Berger, who is a friend and comrade of David Gilbert. David Gilbert has just written the book Love and Struggle, My Life in SDS, The Weather Underground and Beyond. You mentioned Mumia Abu-Jamal, Dan. Mumia is one of the people on the
recording we're about to play, and it was a recording that you helped put together to publicize David's book. Mumia says, Gilbert adds heart and bone to the stuff of history, and Mumia is going to be reading from David's book, and David is going to be reading from it too. So I wanted to now go to those readings that you produced, and then come back to you so we can talk about that.
Sounds good.
Let's cut to the reading.
My first demonstration was a picket line protesting segregated and, more to the point, inferior education for black children in Boston. I don't remember the exact time and place, but the first time I saw him speak on TV, this ripple went through my chest. My heart leapt to his idealism, responding with, "That's what it means to be human, to care about people, to lead a moral and engaged life." Despite my initial defensiveness, Black Power taught an important political lesson. The need was not, as I had once thought, to shake the moral conscience of America. Those in power knew very well what they were doing. The point, rather, was to overturn who had power, from the small elite on top to the vast majority underneath them. Students, in addition to taking a stand on the great issues of the day, were saying something about what kind of institution we wanted to be part of.
We could not be free, grow, and acquire the knowledge we needed in a structure based on oppressing other people. We demanded that the university stand on the side of humanity.
We had been nurtured and mentored. We had blossomed and grown. We had been inspired and learned so much. Students for a Democratic Society was born in response to the courageous breakthroughs of the national liberation movements in the Third World and the determined struggles of people of color within the United States.
The turning point came in January 1967 when Ramparts magazine published a series of color photos of Vietnamese children burned by U.S. napalm bombs. I've never gotten those pictures out of my mind. From then on, for many of us, it was all out to end the war.
We saw how systematically our government crushed peaceful and democratic efforts for the poor. At the same time, revolutionary movements around the world were mobilizing the oppressed and achieving dramatic social change. It was time for us to move from protest to resistance.
The phone wakes us up at 2 a.m. This is Sunny. Everyone has to clear out of the apartment, the familiar but now breathless voice urges. Immediately, don't stop to pack. The four of us are out of the Pine Street apartment and into the night in minutes with just the clothes on our backs. We carefully weave our way to another safe house. There we wait until 6 o'clock to send our one non-fugitive back to check out the area. He reports that the Pine Street apartment is swarming with police and FBI.
As my son approached college age, he became the strongest advocate for my expressing my sorrow and regrets for the loss of lives and pain caused by our actions on October 20th, 1981, in a direct and forthright manner. And I've done so publicly on a number of occasions. The colossal social violence of imperialism does not grant those of us who fight it a free pass to become callous ourselves. Especially in fighting for a just cause, we need to take the greatest care to respect life and to minimize violence as we struggle to end violence.
From inside prisons, I've seen, in even more detail and with greater intensity, how central and deep racism is in this society.
With a black imprisonment rate something like 8 times that of whites, and especially with mass incarceration as the spearhead to the government's counterattack against the 1960s upsurges in the black and Latino communities.
While I've been kept in the most restrictive of New York's prisons, I have not faced the near total isolation of the supermaxes, such as California's Pelican Bay and the federal prison in Florence, Colorado.
Like all prisoners, I deal with a major loss of control over many aspects of my life, arbitrary authority, and physical separation from loved ones and activities.
but I have a tremendous amount of love in my life.
I've been able to stay engaged politically with the world and our movement.
Dan, you created this. Will you please tell us who the people were that we heard reading from David's Love and Struggle?
Sure. So obviously David himself was the first voice and last voice on that clip. The other readers were Sundiata Okolai, a black political prisoner, former member of the Black Panthers, who spent almost 40 years in prison, Mumia Abu-Jamal, as well as two younger hip-hop activists and spoken word artists, Walida Imarisha, who is also friends with David, and Invincible, a hip-hop artist from Detroit.
One of the very strong impressions I came away from after having read the book was just how current David is with what's going on politically in America. It's quite amazing. Like Mumia, both of them are so aware of what's happening in the United States, they can actually write books about politics in the United States from a prison cell. I want to know, what's it like when you go visit David?
Yeah, I actually was just there about 2 weeks ago, and you're absolutely right. I mean, I think it's some of the most politically and intellectually stimulating conversations I have come in prison visits with David and with others. I think there are figures, you know, David and Mumia among them, who have just done so amazingly at being able to stay connected to not only the sort of current events, so to speak, but to people's struggles all over the world. And these are folks who read voraciously and who engage in dialogues with a wide range of people. I finished my PhD about 2 years ago, and David is far more well-read than I am on so many topics.
Really, well, he's had more time than you, Dan. Thank you very much for everything you've done in support of David Gilbert, and you're helping him with Love and Struggle. Particularly, you're publicizing the book. Thank you, Dan, for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Bye, Dan.
Now we're joined by Naomi Jaffe. Naomi, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael.
How did you get to know David Gilbert?
David and I met when we were both graduate students at the New School in New York in the 67, that must have been. And we were co-founders of New School SDS. We were fiery young students together for several years in New York.
What was the purpose of David's writing, Love and Struggle?
David says in the book that he wrote it because young people were asking him about what the lessons were from that period. He's a pretty modest person, and he, for a long time, he resisted writing about his own life. He felt that if there was something that we could do with the lessons from those years of struggle that would be useful to young people, that he was obligated to write it. And one of the most exciting things that's happened with me in connection with this book is that when we did a book celebration for this book in Troy, where I live, one of the young people that I work with in the prisoner justice movement, a young woman in her 20s, stood up and said, "This book feels like a letter from David to me that says that we in my generation have a right to this legacy, that this history is our legacy, and we have a right to be part of this conversation. And these generations, our generations, have an obligation to speak to each other and to pass on the legacy."
That's really a beautiful thought. What do you think the lessons that people are drawing from Love and Struggle?
I think there are multiple lessons. That first one is part of the lessons. The way that our generations have much to learn from each other is, I think, the first lesson is of passing a legacy from generation to generation. There's a huge amount about racism and white supremacy and being a white ally. A lot of the book has to do with race as a basis, with an analysis of race and an analysis of how you move in a way as a white person to oppose white supremacy. But a place where that's particularly poignant for me is a story that David tells right at the beginning of the book. He was at Columbia, and this is about his transition from being a liberal to being a radical. one of the programs that they had at Columbia was Columbia students tutoring kids, Harlem, black kids in Harlem. And David became part of that program, and he was tutoring a kid in Harlem in the 60s. And it was at the time that the U.S. was bombing North Vietnam. He went into Harlem to tutor this kid, and he was all upset about the bombing of North Vietnam. And when he came to the door, the mother of the child that he was tutoring looked at his face and said, "Dave, what are you? I can see you're very upset. What happened?" And he said, "Our country is bombing people on the other side of the world for no reason." And the woman said to him, "Bombing people on the other side of the world for no good reason, huh? Must be colored people that live there."
Yeah.
And that opened up for him, who had been working in both arenas. It was like a revelation. It was his moment of understanding the connection between racism at home and global racism. And he goes on to talk about the way that Malcolm X made that connection. And to me, it's not only about the connection, but it's about learning who you learn from. His ability to learn from the people that he worked with in Harlem, his ability to figure out that the clearest analysis of an oppressive system as a whole comes from people that are on the receiving end of it.
Yeah, I remember Malcolm famously saying about the relationship between racism and capitalism. He said, "You can't get a chicken from a duck's egg, and if you ever did, it'd be a pretty revolutionary chicken."
and he said, David says that Malcolm is the person who really opened not only his eyes, but really all of the eyes of our generation of people of all colors to the global nature of the system that we live under.
Personally, it certainly was true of me. I heard Malcolm speak at the University of Wisconsin in 1964. You know, I can still remember being there and listening to him. And I think that he had the same effect on David. What's been the reaction of people to the book? It's been getting some publicity. I know there were a couple of forums at the Left Forum about it. The Breck Forum had a program about it. What's been the feedback so far?
People have been very enthusiastic, and I think the purpose for which David wrote it, I think, is beginning to be realized, that people are starting to read it for that transfer of information from one generation to another. There's been a lot of interest. The work that I do is around prisoner justice, and there's been a lot of interest in David as a prisoner, as a long-term political prisoner. And I think one of the lessons is how David has survived as a prisoner.
Yeah, talk to us about that. It's just remarkable. He's doing a hard time for 30 years. He was in Clinton, and now he's in a prison in Auburn, 6 hours away from New York. He's one of the senior citizens in the place, so he's isolated in a lot of different ways. How does he get by day to day?
I think he's not isolated in prison for a number of reasons. One is because of his history. He and the other political prisoners, the other political prisoners from that era, have a lot of respect in the prison system, not from the system itself, but from their fellow prisoners who know something about that history, and particularly from the black prisoners who know about the connection to the history of black struggles. That, of course, is particularly the older prisoners, but some of the younger ones as well. And so part of that survival has to do with the relationship with other prisoners, and part of it has to do with a very strong and ongoing relationship with people on the outside, including all of these young people who wrote to him, many as a result of the film The Weather Underground, who wrote to him and to ask him about the lessons of that generation. He wrote an earlier book, which was a collection of essays called No Surrender. And I want to just say a word about that title, No Surrender, and what that means in terms of his survival.
Yes, please do.
It didn't mean no surrender in a military sense. What it meant was, how do you maintain your spirit? How do you maintain spirit and survival of your integrity in the face of the worst that this system has to offer you? And the way that David has survived is by keeping his focus on being able to be part of a struggle for a better world, figuring out under these really limiting conditions how to maintain the integrity of his commitment to justice and how to put that into practice. And this book, Love and Struggle, is one manifestation of his struggle against tremendous odds to be productive in the sense of being part of a struggle for a better world. And I think that that's how he survived. I think that's how our political prisoners survive, is by being part of a struggle for a better world and not giving up on that.
Naomi, I have a question. Maybe it's for you, or it's maybe a lesson from the book. The other day I was at the Trayvon Martin demonstration in Manhattan at Union Square, and it was incredible, a massive demonstration, just massive. And it was probably 80% people of color, African-Americans, but 80%. I've been to a number of the Occupied Wall Street demonstrations, and they're probably the reverse, 80% white. And so I'm interested in both the perspective that David's book, Love and Struggle, would give to that, as well as your own thoughts on that.
David's been very excited by the Occupy movement in spite of its limitations. I think that the hope for being able to sustain any of these struggles really has to do with our ability to put them together. From the point of view of the Occupy movement, the ability to center the narrative, as they say these days, it's not what we said in the 60s, to center the narrative of people of color and of the most oppressed people as the foundation of understanding our system as a whole. And in order to do that, you have to be in active solidarity. So in active solidarity with movements like the movement in response to the killing of Trayvon Martin.
That's really, to me, why Love and Struggle is such an important book today. That's when I went to that demonstration. It's the lessons that you get from that book and what you just said, really, that are critical.
The lesson is solidarity. The lesson is to be in solidarity. And that's a lesson for everyone of all colors. Our ability to move forward, our ability to really challenge the system in a fundamental way has to do with our solidarity. Particularly across lines of race, but global solidarity, I think, is a really important piece of David's book, and it's an important piece of the legacy of Malcolm that David talks about in that book.
Love and Struggle by David Gilbert, My Life in SDS, The Weather Underground and Beyond. We've been speaking with Naomi Jaffe about Love and Struggle. We thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder, and we look forward to getting out more news about David and his fight to get out of Auburn prison. Thanks, Naomi.
Thank you as well.
Thank you, Naomi. It was a really moving short interview with you, but I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. In a case that shocks the conscience, tests were conducted by the U.S. Public Health Service on more than 5,000 individuals in Guatemala. From 1946 to at least 1953, over 1,000 people were deliberately infected with sexually transmitted diseases. The victims included inmates, soldiers, the mentally ill, and commercial sex workers, none of whom had consented or knew about the experimentations on their bodies. It's important to note that the experimentation in Guatemala was overseen by the same laboratory, the Public Health Service's Venereal Disease Research Laboratory, as the STD experiments at Tuskegee. In fact, some of the same researchers were involved, as were some of the same diseases.
In the Tuskegee case, the parties reached a $10 million settlement in 1974, in which the U.S. promised to provide medical benefits to the participants and established the Tuskegee Health Benefit Program. Meanwhile, a class action lawsuit has been filed on behalf of eight individuals who claim to have been victims in the Guatemalan case, spouses or descendants of victims, and is now winding its way through federal courts. We're joined by Piper Hendricks, an attorney working on the Guatemalan case. She has served as the International Justice Project Director of the World Organization for Human Rights USA in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Piper, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
We've heard about the atrocities that the U.S. government perpetrated on thousands of individuals in Guatemala in the late 40s to early 50s. Can you give us a brief overview of what happened?
What happened is that the experiments began in 1946, and we have to remember that this is a time around the end of World War II when a lot of soldiers were coming back with syphilis and other venereal diseases, and the medical authorities in the United States wanted to find a way to treat this because a lot of our soldiers were ending up out of commission. And so there were experiments that were begun in the United States, and you know, some advances were made, but what they really wanted to do was find out how to treat syphilis right after exposure. But in order to do that, you needed to find a way to expose people to it and have people who were there and thus you know, better subjects for the immediate application of some sort of treatment. And so there were experiments going on in Terre Haute, Indiana, and I think we're all familiar with many that were going on in Tuskegee, Alabama. But there were ethical limitations of what the researchers could do in the United States, which, you know, as an aside, obviously many of those were violated in Tuskegee, Alabama. But wanting to have a more vulnerable population and get away with things that would not be acceptable here in the United States, the U.S. medical researchers went down to Guatemala and targeted vulnerable populations there, including orphans, mental health patients, prisoners, soldiers, and people who never gave consent personally to be part of these experiments.
Piper, how did they expose these individuals?
They used a number of different methods. There were things like bringing spinal fluid out of the spinal column, mixing that with syphilitic material, and injecting it back into the person.
So this would be, for example, when the person was in the hospital, how did they get them in there to start with?
Well, the populations that they were working with were all in various institutions already. You had mental health patients in the mental health institution. You have orphans who are already in the orphanage. You have soldiers who are under the command of the commanding officers, and people who are already there, for lack of a better word, captive. And so the experiments took place in those institutions where people were already institutionalized. And they used different methods such as mixing, really quite disturbing, mixing material from genitalia into water and having people drink it, really disturbing things, scrapes and you know, into different regions of the body and directly introducing pus and other infections there.
Ooh. When was this discovered? When did this come to light?
It all came to light very recently, just in October of 2010. Professor Susan Reverby up at Wellesley College was looking at some of the materials from Tuskegee, Alabama, and realized that what she was seeing was not just from Alabama, but also from Guatemala. So it all came to light in that fall of 2010. And when it did, President Obama, Secretary Clinton, and Secretary Sebelius all promptly apologized to the Guatemalan people and to the world, acknowledging that what had happened was particularly egregious and unethical and illegal.
I have a question for you. This is 46 to 53 in Guatemala. Is that about right?
It's about right. Yeah, there's no indication of when exactly it ended, but the records indicate it lasted at least until 1953.
And the Tuskegee experiment, which, you know, most of us know about it, is a complete atrocity. But what period was that? Around the same time?
It started around the same time, a bit earlier, and lasted until around the 70s. So it went longer. And what's interesting about Tuskegee is when it first began, it wasn't as unethical as when it ended, in the sense that there wasn't a known treatment for syphilis at the time. And so they brought in people who were already infected and wanted to watch the course of the disease. You know, what does it do to the human body left untreated? But then when penicillin became a known remedy for syphilis, the fact that it was withheld and that people were very, very intentionally misled about what was going on made that particularly egregious in Alabama.
Just remind us, who was involved in the Tuskegee experiment? Who were the people they were looking at, them in the group?
The test subjects there were about 600 African-American men, all living in the area of Alabama, and the experimenters were part of the United States Public Health Service. A lot of overlap with the team there and the team in Guatemala. Dr. Cutler was one who was involved in both places.
What was the discussion in terms of the criteria of picking non-white people to be victimized? They went to Tuskegee, Alabama. They went down to Guatemala, which is a lot of indigenous people. Was any kind of conscious discussion about the racism involved in this?
There was, actually, both at the time and, you know, obviously in hindsight, people have noted that there's absolutely a racial element to both experiments. I think in Tuskegee, you have a population that's not as well protected at the time, definitely not respected. I mean, this is all pre-civil rights movement and really a vulnerable population. In Guatemala, it was acknowledged in some of the correspondence between the U.S. researchers that there were things that they could not get away with in the United States, but they could in Guatemala because people were not looking out for the interests of the populations there. And because they were just seen, I mean, some of the comments are particularly disturbing. I mean, indicating that people who were of certain descent wouldn't understand the procedures, and so therefore there was no obligation to explain things to them or try to get their consent, which is just, it's disgusting that there, as a researcher, it's your obligation to put whatever you're doing in terms that someone can understand, and to put the blame on the people who were victimized is really disturbing.
Now, Piper, what you've just said so clearly violates all medical ethics, the pledges that doctors take. Tell us the grounds for the lawsuit that is now pending. Does it involve any of that violation? On behalf of practitioners?
It does. We've brought several claims, some under international law and then some as constitutional violations. And the international law claims look at specifically the non-consensual human medical experimentation and then also bring a claim for cruel and human degrading treatment. And that's something that the statute that we're proceeding under, the Alien Tort Statute, is one that you can't use in U.S. court unless you clear the hurdle of having a violation of international law. It has to be something that's so egregious that the entire world essentially agrees that this is something that is wrong and should not be done. And that's where, with the non-consensual human medical experimentation, I mean, we only need to look at Nuremberg and see that's a perfect example of the entire world coming out and saying this is something we do not accept. And as you alluded to, I mean, this is something that's part of the Hippocratic Oath. I mean, the medical profession has known this for centuries. I mean, there's just never a question that you should not be intentionally infecting people and causing such harm.
Piper, who are the plaintiffs and who are the defendants?
Yeah, I was going to ask that too. How do you defend a case like this?
The plaintiffs that we're representing are the people who were individually involved in the experiments and their family members. And given that the nature of the diseases that were involved, this is something that you pass on to your spouse and potentially to your children. And so that's something that we're now representing the individual survivors and their heirs as well. The defendants in this case are the U.S. government and the Pan American Health Organization, which is the subsequent organization from the Pan American Sanitary Health Bureau. So the PASB is what existed in the 1940s, and that's now transformed into PAHO, the Pan American Health Organization.
And what are their defenses? Statute of limitations, procedural stuff? How can they substantially defend against this?
Oh, that's a good question. If you look at the defenses, it's almost like a Lincoln Logs, the way everything sort of fits together just right so that you can't reach the government the way they're arguing things. First of all, they're arguing that they should be substituted under the Westfall Act for any individual defendants. And so on the theory that these defendants, the individual doctors, were acting within the scope of employment, and that from the very get-go, I mean, there's a big question mark there. Can you say that intentionally infecting people with venereal diseases really truly was within the scope of employment? And we naturally argue it was not. But then when you substitute the U.S. government, you're then proceeding under the Federal Tort Claims Act. And in sum, you can only sue the U.S. government when the U.S. government gives you permission to do so. So it's like the fox guarding the hen house here.
This is, you know, this is what happens for 10 years at the Center for Constitutional Rights. It's the exact same issue. You sue the individuals. They claim it's within the scope of employment, whether it's torture or whatever else. They substitute the federal government. And then there's all kinds of immunities about the federal government outside the country, et cetera, et cetera. So I assume that's the same issue, right?
Yeah, and it's pretty remarkable. I mean, you look at, in one context, they're saying, well, we can't reach them because all of the decisions were made in the United States, looking at the law of the District of Columbia. But then not a few paragraphs later, you say, well, you can't reach us because all this conduct took place in a foreign country. So there's a lot of selectivity in when you're looking at what conduct and what laws. And I think at the end of the day, when you take a step back and say, you know, really, are we going to say that our government is immune for violating this portion of international law? And we think that the answer is absolutely not.
Let me go back. Where are you, in the district court, the lowest court?
We are. Right now we're proceeding in the federal court in the District of Columbia.
And has there been an argument on this yet?
Not yet. We filed the case in March of 2010 and then told it for a while. The Presidential Commission for Bioethics was looking at all the evidence that was available. And what's interesting in this case is that Dr. Cutler kept pretty extensive records. And so even though it happened decades ago, we have a good starting point on understanding what happened.
Before you go there, I want to get a sense. There was a settlement in the Tuskegee case.
There was a
settlement or a congressional award. I don't remember which. But because in some way, I think the legal obstacles, I mean, you may get through them, but I know that having litigated many of these cases, they're not the easiest ones in the world. They're good to put pressure on and maybe win. But is there any efforts in Congress to sort of match the Tuskegee settlement for people in Guatemala, or is that just not there yet?
We've been talking to people on the Hill and encouraging a response to this as soon as possible. I mean, given the passage of time, we're dealing with very old populations and people who have actually passed away since the filing of the case, which is really sad to think that people would find out that they've been wronged in this way and then die never seeing justice. Unfortunately, as we all know, there's a lot of issues going on right now on the Hill, and we're in an election year. And so far, we haven't had any sort of concrete response at this time.
I have a question about the year it ended, 1953. Our Benz, who was the democratically elected president of Guatemala, took office, I think, around that time, right at 1953. He's overthrown by the United States in 1954. Mm-hmm. Was the fact that there was a democratically elected government anything to do with the ultimate stopping of this experiment in Guatemala?
I think that there are a number of factors as to why it ended. And again, we're not entirely clear exactly when it ended. We just have records that cut off at that point, but there's no indication that they affirmatively packed up shop and went home. I think that there were starting to be questions here in the United States. The people who had been overseeing the experiment were leaving their posts, and so it just became a little too risky to keep going there. And so once Dr. Cutler left, that's when a lot of the records cut off. But I think, as you're saying, you know, that the change in the administration in Guatemala, more questions being asked in the United States, just a number of things made it not as viable as it had been previously.
Piper, especially since Dr. Cutler kept such good records, are there any plans to write a book about this?
I wouldn't be surprised. This has gotten a lot of attention, not as some domestically, but very much internationally. And there's a lot of people who have been going down and meeting with people in Guatemala. And I don't know. I mean, I haven't spoken to anybody who has definite plans to write a book, but it definitely would be one that would be interesting to have the whole story together.
Now, I note that your background includes serving as the International Justice Project Director of the World Organization for Human Rights, USA, and you manage the civil case of Charles Taylor, Jr. Can you tell us briefly about that, winning a spectacular $22 million in damages for five torture victims?
Well, that was a really exciting case. I mean, as you may know, that the criminal case against him was the first of its kind brought under the U.S. version of the Convention Against Torture. And that was an exciting day to see the United States bringing that case against someone who had done such egregious things in Liberia and who many people aren't aware is a U.S. citizen. So that was really amazing to see him put away then for 97 years. The difference, though, between a criminal case and a civil case, criminal penalizes the person who committed all the wrongs. But the civil case is what we sought to then have a remedy for the people who were wronged. And we represented five Liberians in that case. We brought it as a class action. Unfortunately, it was not certified as such. But then won the judgment against him, again, under the Alien Tort Statute, which is a really, it was a powerful case, both in the end result and then also bringing the plaintiffs in to face the person who had done this. As you might know, the Liberian Civil War is one of the most violent in history. And so to have the ending where, you know, that there's a bit of justice there was really rewarding.
Very impressive. And let's just ask this question. How do we know that our government right now is not continuing to test human subjects?
I don't know that we know that for certain. And that's one thing that's so important about this case is realizing this is not something that's just in the past. If we look now at the experiments that are taking place in Africa, for example, some involving governments, some involving only private entities or private corporations working with governments, it's not clear that we have the level of consent that we should on all fronts. And by now, you'd think that we would have, you know, so many years after World War II, we'd have a little bit more clarity on this issue. Following the Tuskegee experiments, there was another review and a review of our laws to try to ensure that we protected human subjects, but it's not clear that we're quite there yet.
If you prevail in this case, is this setting any kind of precedent?
I would hope so. I mean, as Michael mentioned, you know, that there's the government is prone to assert immunity whenever it's available. And that's understandable in a way if you look at the very, you know, the line level attorney in DOJ. When you're representing your client, even if your client is the United States government, you assert whatever defenses are available. But I think what the administration, this administration, any future administration needs to do is take a step back and say, wait a minute, is this the type of case where we want to be asserting immunity, even if the law might be an arguable defense, but it's just when you look at it in the greater context of international law and human rights, these are actions that are indefensible. So it's our hope that a win in this case would be, you know, a step in the right direction for future administrations not to get to this point. I mean, we initially approached the government suggesting that we could settle this out of court before, you know, without having to file a case at all. Unfortunately, we got no response, and so did file it. But it's something that's unfortunate that we've had to go on, you know, nearly a year and a half now after things have come to light without any sort of remedy for the people who were involved.
Piper Hendricks, it's been a pleasure to have you on. You're doing fabulous work, and we hope to stay in touch with you.
Great to talk to you, Piper.
Thank you, Piper.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut him down. Tell him that God's gonna cut him down. Well, my goodness gracious, let me tell you the news. My head's been wet with the midnight dew. I've been down on...